Blog Talk Radio.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad.
Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. Damn it! My life has value! So, I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Everybody, and welcome to Islam Exposed with your host, Tim Burton, Agador, and myself. I'm Kel Fritzy. We started this program because we are three hosts, three different countries with one common denominator, our love of freedom and a planet rid of the scourge. We are here to speak about issues of Islam, but we're also here to hold our respective government's feet to the fire. This is the premise of Islam Exposed and how our governments are not protecting us. But I want to bring in the fellow host and say hello to Tim. Hi, Tim.
Well, good evening, Kel, or good afternoon, I should say, to you over there in sunny Canada. It's evening here, of course. and I can hear Agador chuckling away in the background. So good evening, good afternoon to you, Agador. And I hope you are both well. I'm unbelievably well, before you ask.
Well, as usual, I am infidelity fine. Hello, Agador. How are you today?
Oh, I'm beautiful here in sunny Vermont. Yeah, I've got a thunderstorm right over my head, lightning crashing all over the place. That's right. There are electrical displays going on. This is going to be an electric show. I mean, you could actually have a glowy panelist here. So anything
well played,
can
sir.
Happen.
Well played.
Yes, I prefer to think of it as Allah marking his approval for this show and giving us the seal of approval for our discussions alike. So thanks, Big Al. Thank you for that, mate. Yeah, good
Big
on you.
There you are, yep.
Oh, we do have quite a busy show today. And but before we get into the program, I do have to offer a big thank you to you, Agador, for helping me clean up the opening segment of this program. I sent you the MP3, and you helped me clean it up, and it is pristine. So thank you for that.
Oh, you're quite welcome, Kelly. It still needs work, but I think it's somewhat improved, and it gives people a chance to get into the chat room and kind of say hello to each other and that kind of thing. And that's what we encourage.
Yeah, but you know what? I think you did such a good job that I think it's personally, I'm biased, of course. But I think it turned out perfect. You have a much better mixer system than I do.
I only have what you do, Kel, and that's just a computer program and a microphone, and that's all I've got. But thank you for the compliment. I appreciate
Absolutely. And I have some programming notes. As you know, Red Fox Blogger is home to various radio hosts. Everybody, of course, is familiar with Mike Holt of Restore Australia, heard here on Wednesday afternoons. Well, I'm on the case again, and we might have a new radio host where I will act as silent producer as I do with Mike Holt. I will keep you apprised of that, but believe me, you are going to love this radio host. He is prolific in the counter-jihad movement, and he interviews people globally. So I'm very much in talks with him. He might be on a Tuesday installment. I will keep you titillated, and maybe I'll let you know who it is next week.
Oh,
but
very
exciting. There you go. But I want Agador to start with this. and then what I want is for Tim to pick it up because, Tim, you wrote an article about this, and Agador, you sent some clips about this. I'm very, very concerned about the approach that the Obama administration is taking. I have some clips here that we're going to play a little later, but Agador, please explain, in particular, Nancy Pelosi's decision, and then we'll play a clip by Hillary Clinton.
Oh, well, Pelosi was known, has been heard this week to say that, or to confirm that Hamas is a charitable organization. And I suppose that's true if you look at the mafia as a charitable organization as well. they do operate in a similar fashion. But this woman absolutely has, I really do believe that the average lizard has more fellow human feeling for other people than Nancy Pelosi. That statement of hers just... is only overshadowed by Hillary Clinton's statement, but it really shows how paid off our public officials here in the United States are, and it really is something that embarrasses me as an American that our leaders, I don't have to agree with them politically, but one would like to think that our leaders are statesmen and stateswomen, and these comments are proving that they are merely people who stand up for power, their own power, whenever they can get it. And to me, they're obviously paid off, because no one with any sense can think that Hamas is just a charitable organization. And then Hillary Clinton, comes out with a statement that says that, Hamas operates in civilian areas because the Gaza area is so small. And that's not the worst of what she said. Throughout the interview that that was done, she implied that everything was Israel's fault. Said that Hamas is back. She does first admit that Hamas was firing missiles into Israel. Then she says that, well, Hamas's back was to the wall and they had to fire more missiles. Well, of course their back was to the wall. They were the ones firing missiles in the first place. They provoked it. Then she says, oh, well, they're operating in civilian areas in Gaza because Gaza is so small. And this brings into question, and you guys have both heard this, the whole thing that people are saying, well, these poor Gazan Arabs, I love that designation, Tim, have nowhere else to go, forgetting places like, I don't know, Jordan, Egypt, just two off the top of my head that they could go to immediately. But this plays into that whole thing. The Hillary Clinton remarks are just amazing in their heartlessness and in their cluelessness. She has to know that these things are going on. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to put in, while you guys comment, I'm going to put in a link to the Town Hall article that I found. And this is what's so sad for all of our listeners. This is what is so sad in this whole thing. We like to prep as much for these shows as we possibly can. Do all the work for you so that you find it worth it to come here and listen and hear what we have to say. To find this story on Town Hall took me less than 5 minutes. That shouldn't be the case. All of our governments should and of course this is opinion on my part, but I do support Israel. All of our governments should be recognizing Hamas for the terrorist organization that it is, and the fact that they aren't is maddening, frustrating, and heartbreaking. But I'll turn it back over to you guys and let you comment on the article that I just placed from Town Hall in the chat room.
Agador, thank you very much, and I'm going to pass the mic to Tim in a moment, but what Agador posted is, there's also a clip there that we're going to play momentarily, but just to give you a bit of a verbatim read, Hamas doesn't operate in civilian areas because it's a pretty small place, not even in part. Hamas intentionally and deliberately operates in civilian populations, including in schools and mosques, in order to get innocent Palestinians killed so they can use dead bodies as propaganda against Israel. Hamas purposefully uses human beings as shields, period. Hamas doesn't operate inside civilian areas, in part. That's where their entire operation and propaganda campaign is based. And before I play this clip by Hillary Clinton, I would love Tim's input on this.
Yeah, thanks, Cal. Well, as you say, I did actually write about this. The article isn't online yet, but it's scheduled to be published tomorrow. But basically, the thrust of the article was that people from the Obama administration must be smoking something. They must be on something, or it must be something in the water, because they're just coming out with such crazy statements. It's not just a little bit of light propaganda. It is stuff which any thinking person who's been following the course of the conflict over the past 3 weeks would immediately just recognize as just plain stupidity. And it prompted me to say that my cat could do a better job than the entire Obama administration combined. And at this moment, I'm filling in an application form for my cat so that he can apply to make some more sense. Well, indeed. I mean, he can't possibly do a worse job. And given a few tins of decent cat treats and maybe a nice little dinky collar with a bell on it, he'd probably do a job that was much better than the current incumbents. I mean, we had John Kerry, who was trying to, well, in his words, trying to negotiate a ceasefire and talk to Qatar and Turkey without getting any Israeli input, and came back with a document that, surprise, surprise, was slanted entirely in favour of Hamas, and didn't address any of Israel's short-term or long-term problems at all. Demands like, oh, you've got to open up all the borders between Gaza and Egypt, and you've got to build us a nice big new seaport so we can, you know, import some more humanitarian foodstuffs and things like that, you know. Oh, yeah, no rockets or tunnel-building materials or anything. Oh, heaven forfend. So we got John Kerry there, and then, as you say, Ag, we had Hillary Clinton saying that the reason Hamas has to fire its rockets and stuff from populated civilian areas is because Gaza's a small place, you know. And she, I mean, in an ideal world for Hillary Clinton, you know, she'd be able to provide Hamas with a list of Gazan real estate agents and say, well, look, we're looking for a Des Rez, you know, downtown Gaza, and it's got to have, you know, central heating, hot and cold running water, and plenty of storage space for rockets and explosives. And to be fair, you know, most Gazan real estate agents probably don't include that in their advertising, when they're advertising properties, you know, in downtown Gaza. But I mean, that's what she's after. And of course, you can see if you look on Google Maps, which I thought I would have a go, you can see there's plenty of spaces that are not in the middle of populated civilian areas. I mean, Gaza is not one huge populated place with no spare spaces at all. The reason Hamas do what they do is because they want and need civilian deaths, and if they don't get civilian deaths in sufficient quantities, they lose a massive propaganda tool, and that is the reason they do it. I mean, also, it helps if they can have their weapons protected, which obviously they wouldn't be protected if they were away from civilian areas, but that's a secondary concern, I think, for people like that. They are just such a depraved and immoral group, and think nothing of putting their own civilians in harm's way, that for Hillary Clinton to come out with a comment like that in the face of all the evidence. I mean, that's the second application form I'm filling in for my cat. If he doesn't get John Kerry's position, he's definitely going to apply for Hillary Clinton's position. And of course,
I love what Bigfoot put in the chat room. He said, Tim, get a tan, learn a bit of Spanish, go to Mexico, walk northward, and both you and your cat can be registered to vote.
Absolutely. Listen, you and June can do that, and I will sponsor you. I will sponsor both of you. It'll be awesome. I can squeeze you both in this little apartment here. So
that sounds like a deal. And I just wanted to finish off by saying Nancy Pelosi really completes the team. I mean, yeah, that's the third application form I've had to get out in front of me as we speak. And by saying, yeah, Qatar has told me over and over again that Hamas is a humanitarian organization. And again, you know, you summed it up quite succinctly, like the mafia is a humanitarian organization, like Genghis Khan's Mongol hordes were a humanitarian organization, like the Nazi SS brigades in World War II were a humanitarian organization. You know, what is she smoking? You know, you think, I've got to have some of that, because it's just, their brains are just completely addled. And these are people who, you know, effectively they form the top echelon of the administration that supposedly runs the most powerful free country in the world. And they're coming out with these statements as if, you know, nobody's going to see straight through them straight away. They're coming out with statements which are just so patently absurd, you just can't credit it. So there we go. My cat's making out. Well, I'm making out on behalf of my cat. Three application forms, and if we can't get one out of three, I think it will be a poor job. That's what I think. So back to you guys.
can I break in for a second, Kel?
Yes, please.
Do you mind? Okay, thank you. all right. What Tim is pointing out about what he's seen on Google Maps is very important, because people need to understand the rockets that they're firing into Israel are not just these little barely guided Qassam rockets that they've been firing into there for the past 10 or so years. they're more and more sophisticated. In fact, they have a range that qualifies them as quote-unquote theory or theater area rockets. In other words, these things can go a very, very long distance. They could fire rockets over Israel from Gaza into other countries if they wanted to. So they don't need to be right where they are. As Tim says, they don't need to find a real estate agent in Gaza and say, listen, can we get an apartment building that's convenient to parks and schools and has rooftop missile launching facilities just so we can launch them into Israel? They don't need all that. They can move their missile launchers out of populated areas, and it's very obvious that they're using human shields. And I don't have the story up. I wish I did, but if anyone wants to search for this, this came up late last night. An Italian reporter who has left the area of Gaza and is no longer afraid of reprisal from Hamas has said that, yes, indeed, Hamas did put children in danger and that they are using children as human shields. Now, this is an Italian reporter. I do not know his name, but if anyone wants to search that out, that story is out there. That came to me last night. And back to you, Kel. Thanks for letting me break in.
Absolutely. And what we're going to do, we're going to speak about Nancy Pelosi. We have a few clips here that we do want to share with you, audio clips. But let's listen to Hillary Clinton. And this is courtesy, of course, of Agador. So here we go.
Would you feel totally comfortable right now to get on a commercial airliner and go to Israel tonight?
Yes. I mean, I negotiated the last ceasefire in November 2012. And I know that there were concerns by our FAA and the Europeans. Those have been alloyed. They're not as severe. But I think you have to constantly be watching to make sure that flights are safe. But right now,
but
I think
you wouldn't be afraid.
I would not be.
Now, the current conflict started with the killings of 14, three Israelis,
right,
and one Palestinian. But so far, more than 700 Palestinians have died,
right,
more than 30 Israelis have died, most of them civilians. Do you think that Israel somehow responded in a disproportionate way?
Jorge, it's such a tragic situation. I think Hamas intended to provoke Israel because that's why they started the rocket fire again, as I say, when I negotiate ceasefire, it held until just this month. And then Hamas, which has its back against the wall, decided to once again fire rockets into Israel. Israel made it clear that wasn't acceptable. Hamas kept doing it. Israel said, we have to stop the rockets. And then they discovered all these tunnels. So obviously Israel has a right to self-defense. But I and everybody who is seeing these terrible pictures on our TV hope there can be a ceasefire and try to end the killing and try to prevent the unbelievable heartbreak that we see happening.
What's the appropriate response, you think?
Well, I think what the problem is, and this is something, I'm not a military planner, but Hamas puts its missiles, its rockets in civilian areas. Part of it is that Gaza is pretty small and it's very densely populated. They put their command and control of Hamas military leaders in those civilian areas. Israel, I know, has sent warnings and tried to get people to move. But in any kind of conflict, there are going to be civilian casualties, and we need to try to get to a ceasefire as soon as possible.
What a crazy bitch. And this person is aspiring to be president of the United States, and I like what you said in the chat room, Agador. She's not a military planner, but she wants to be president. Is this woman totally delusional, or what is going on here? Like, the one thing that struck me, of course, is that statement that the Gazan Arabs are confined in a rather tight place, and so, you know, what are they to do with their weapons? Yeah, let's store them in hospital schools, mosques. What are, you know, these poor people to do. Oh, Agador, please take this away because I have to spit out some nails here.
I wish I could take her away, to be quite honest with you, and put her in a funny farm. But, I mean, when I said that that these people are paid off, I was being very serious. I think there's a lot of quite a lot of petrodollars going into paying off leaders in all three of our governments to just say these ridiculous things and back these ridiculous policies. What I said in the chat room I think is significant in that I think Israel is beginning to have an impact, and that's why she's calling for an immediate ceasefire.
Mm-hmm.
We Gadi Edelman, if you'll remember, has discussed this himself very well. He said mm-hmm. every time Israel begins to get the upper hand in these conflicts, suddenly the West swoops in and says, oh, got to have a ceasefire. And I'm really hoping that Prime Minister Netanyahu and the people of Israel will not fall for that business this time. If the United States cuts them off from whatever aid they're getting, the government, I can almost guarantee that the people of the United States will find some way to aid Israel. Even if our government won't, they need to finish this job that they've started. And I think it's completely disgusting to watch the woman who will, unless things are quite different, will probably be our next president, saying these things. It's a very chilling scenario for Israel. And I'll throw it back to you guys.
Thanks, Agador. And I agree. The United States is in a very much a state of peril with this current administration and Obama coming out and commiserating with the Palestinians. We stopped calling them that on this show. They are the Gazan Arabs. We sit back internationally. We sit back and listen to him espouse pity for these terrorists that are literally haunting and terrorizing Israel. I agree that I think the international community has to sit this one out and let Israel get the job done, like you say, Agador. I totally agree with that. Tim, you've been writing about this and covering this extensively. I ask you, the international community, time to step down?
Well, I think the most important thing is not to have a ceasefire at the moment. I mean, nobody likes to see innocent people killed in any conflict, but nevertheless, if you're looking for a course of action that will save lives in the long term, then Israel is pursuing the right course of action. There is no way that there can be peace in the area until Hamas is completely and utterly crushed and incapable of mounting any further opposition to Israel at all. Now, that's obviously going to take some time. They've hidden a lot of their weapons away underground, and it's going to take time to find, you know, even if they say, well, let's set a target of, say, finding 90% of these tunnels, that's going to take time because unless they can get a good network of informers in place, they are not going to know where those tunnels are. One point I should say is that I was reading a great article today, and I did put the link into the chat room, but it scrolled up very quickly, so I'm dropping it in again. And it comes from somebody who makes a very valid point about who is and who isn't a civilian, and who is and who isn't a human shield. And there's certainly a case when you're talking about the laws of war, and I'm talking about war from a legal point where people have actually in the past sat down and decided what can and can't be acceptable in the context of war. When you're mm-hmm. talking about civilians versus combatants, if you get the situation where a tunnel is discovered underneath somebody's house, you know, that house is then no longer a civilian structure. It's part it's part of the enemy's military structure, and is perfectly acceptable to be targeted. When civilians run up to the roof of a house to prevent Israeli fire on what they consider to be a military target, they are then no longer civilians. They are combatants, and that's a very important distinction. Quite apart from the advice that Hamas put on their website, which is to say that if anybody is killed in Gaza, you always go straight to the media and you call him an innocent civilian. You don't discuss his military rank if he was one of the fighters. He's always, ever an innocent civilian. And that's why the figures for what is classified in Gaza as innocent civilians, it's one of the reasons they're so high. Because the media get their numbers and descriptions of casualties from Hamas. So the very first thing they say is, oh, the IDF bombed this structure today. It was, you know, it was a mosque or a house or a school. Wasn't a military installation. Oh, no, not at all. And they killed, I don't know, 10 innocent civilians. And, you know, they say indiscriminate bombing by IDF kills these civilians. But if you look at the age groups of the people who are killed, you will see that they are disproportionately, the age group is, we've got a lot of feedback coming in from somewhere, Kill. I don't know where that's coming from.
That's coming from Agador's end. He's air conditioner.
Oh, all right then. We'll have to do something about that.
That's okay. I'll just suffer in silence and be my hot self. Go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, okay. Sorry about that, Agador. Yeah, when you're looking at the breakdown of the ages of people killed, if it was indiscriminate shelling, you would expect 50% of the casualties to be under the age of 15, because that's the average population in Gaza. But in fact, what you find is that well over 50% of the casualties, well over 50% are men in the fighting ages of 18 to 38. And that's why any claim of indiscriminate shelling by IDF, I think, that single statistic alone bears out how much of a lie it is. But, I don't think there's any kind of disproportionality at all. And in the link of that article that I put in, the whole concept of disproportionality or what is proportionate and what is not in a military conflict is actually discussed very succinctly from a legal point of view. And anybody who wants to discuss the situation in the Israel-Gaza conflict with anybody at all could, I think, would find that very, very useful reading, because it puts a totally different perspective on what's actually happening there, and you can see through the propaganda that Hamas are putting forward. But, I'll pass the microphone back to you, Kel, and let you move on.
Okay. Thanks, Tim. And I liked what you were touching upon in your commentary about the tunnels. It looks like Israel has discovered more. I think there's like 30 tunnels that they have discovered, and they are destroying them. And you're absolutely correct in your assessment that if these people are building these tunnels underneath civilian homes, and I'm using air quotes here, then that civilian home is a legitimate target for destruction. I am so sick and tired of reading the mainstream media and that they report, Israel went in and destroyed a residential home. Well, it's not a residential home. It's an army barrack. And what people are, like the chat room is rather busy, and it's true that Hamas, the Gazan Arabs, they do not have residential homes nor schools. That their mosques are their military sites. They're firing rockets into Israel from homes, from schoolyards, from mosques, from hospitals. If Israel finds these a point of direction and where they're coming from. Israel has every single right to take out that installation. I am wishing that the mainstream media would be honest in their reportage, but they're not, because we have the appeasers like Nancy Pelosi and Hillary Clinton and, of course, Barack Hussein Obama, the usurper in the White House, offering platitudes and saying that Palestinians are victims and Israel is the little Satan, you know, as it were. That's how the Islamists refer to them. America is the great Satan. Israel is the little Satan. I am so tired of the appeasement of our major politicians. These are major players on the world stage, ladies and gentlemen. And this is what we are faced with. This is not governance. This is absolutely absolutely shocking to me, in that it seems the only country that is recognizing that Israel has a right to defend herself is Canada, and that is under the steerage of Prime Minister Stephen Harper. I find this shocking that there are not more world leaders supporting Israel's right to exist. And I'm going to pass the mic to Agador in a moment, because I want him to address Nancy Pelosi's position. She was in a I'll tee this up for you, Agador, but this is shocking to me. Nancy Pelosi was in a junket, and she was speaking for 18 minutes. I'm going to try to find the succinct part of that clip. But Nancy Pelosi, who is she? What's her deal? And Agador, why does she hate Israel?
Well, all right, Kel. Nancy Pelosi is typical of, quite honestly, not even the American left, but the world left now. And somehow the left in the world sees Israel as a thorn in the side of an oppressed people that they've decided that Mohammedans are. And this existence of a Jewish state is somehow an offense to the people in the world's left, because it is somehow politically incorrect. Now, I'm not exactly sure why it's politically incorrect for Israel to exist, but somehow it is. And that is the logic that's running through that's running through what remains of Nancy Pelosi's brain. And that is where I think a lot of this stems from, at least in the rank and file in the left wing of our governments around the world. I think you can see people who have bought into the line that Mohammedans are an oppressed people and they must be defended at all costs, regardless of who the Mohammedans are and what the Mohammedans are doing. And I don't believe, again, that we should discount the use of petrodollars in influencing people, because we've seen this with Ms. Pelosi in other issues too. She toes the party line very well, and she does everything with an eye towards advancing leftist causes and advancing Nancy Pelosi. I haven't noticed her offering to step down as from her position of leadership in the Democratic Party, and I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah.
The woman has the same mindset as I said, as people like Hillary Clinton, the Trudeaus, and I'm sure Tim can give me some wonderful people from the UK. The Camerons, yes. All of these people on the left who who won't see the logic of the death and the hate that is coming from the Mohammedans. And I'd like to throw in one other thing, too, if I might, which is that there seems to be a knee-jerk reaction on the part of the left, and it's almost an immature thing, that if people on the right happen to be for something, or if they happen to support something, or if they happen to be in favor of something, that's three different ways of saying the same thing, that people on the left have to be against it. You know, it just follows that if it's something the right likes, it has to be evil, it has to be immoral, it has to be against the people. Someone has to be being oppressed somewhere. It's almost like the movie Monty Python and the Holy Grail, where Arthur is trying to get the peasant to be quiet, and the peasant is shouting at his fellows, you know, help, help, I'm being repressed. Come and see the violence inherent in the system.
I love that movie.
Exactly. They have to have this. And if people on the political right are in support of something, it's almost a childlike, immature reaction that they have to be against it. So I think a lot of different factors play into it. But for the most part, at its base, at its core, Nancy Pelosi is on the left. And I'll turn it back over to you guys, because I think Tim is champing at the bit.
Yeah, I have something here from Nancy Pelosi, but I would love Tim to jump in here and contribute to that.
I do think that we have a huge problem over here with people like David Cameron, who, for a conservative, he's as left-wing as you can possibly get. And there has to be a factor of financial inducement for him, I feel, to say what he says. He's coming out so much in favour of Islam and Muslims in his public statements recently. I mean, this month alone, we've heard him talk about the introduction of Sharia finance in the UK, and he obviously thinks it's a good thing. He doesn't see any problem at all with a parallel system of finance that's inevitably going to be yet one more step into the normalising of Sharia in the country. Now, if anything, we should be rolling back the influence of Sharia in all its forms, whether they're it's financial or with the Sharia courts that we've been seeing being quietly established in the UK over the past few years. At the last count, officially, there were 85 Sharia courts, but considering that a court can be set up by a man in a van with a mobile phone, you know, there's probably 10 times that number, for all we know. Anjem Chowdhury himself has said that he operates a Sharia court from his van and his mobile phone, and if he does it, I'm sure there are people in most towns and cities in the UK who can perform that service for the Muslim community. I mean, it's wrong on all sorts of levels, because Sharia is so biased against women obviously, for one thing. Even if you were to say it's purely for Muslims to voluntarily attend, well, what woman in a Muslim community is going to argue against being told she's got to attend a Sharia court to get a ruling? You know, not if she knows what's good for her or for her kids. She knows that if she puts up any kind of opposition, it could result in something very bad happening to her, up to and including her being killed. So Sharia should not be allowed in any way, shape or form. But Cameron seems very happy to facilitate it, as I say, not just with Sharia finance, Sharia courts. And you should have heard him this month talking about all the good things that Muslims do in giving money to charity. Oh, my goodness, almost made me throw up. He was saying that Muslims are one of the greatest giving groups when it comes to charities. Well, yes, apart from the fact that a Muslim charity only benefits Muslims.
I just snorted water out my nose.
Yeah, well, quite so. A Muslim charity, of course, will only benefit Muslims, whereas a charity, as we normally understand it, benefits everybody. If you give money to a charity, you don't say, oh, it's only got to go to Christians, or it's only got to go to Jews, or it's only got to go to people who have a green horn on the end of their nose or something like that. No offence, Agador. But with Muslims, that seems to be perfectly acceptable. And it amazes me all the time how we keep it's as if we were saying to ourselves, well, you can't expect anything better from Muslims. We're not going to hold them to the same high standards that we will hold ourselves to, and we'll let them get away with all sorts of things. Well, the only problem with that is if they were only, say, 0.5% of the population, you could maybe accommodate that point of view and say, well, it's not a national security issue, all right, it may not be terribly fair on the other members of the Muslim community, but if they're only less than 0.5% of the population, what does it matter? But when they start to become a significant proportion of the population, and I'm sure people who've listened to me speak regularly will know that I'm just about to refer to the study done by Dr. Peter Hammond, who says quite clearly that as the Muslim population increases, the paradigm changes, their whole behaviour changes, with an increase of 1%, 2%, 3%, 4%, 5% and above. You can see distinct changes in the way that they interact with the host population. And when they get to 10% or 15%, they become very, very aggressive, very, very assertive, and start to demand all sorts of things which no other group would ever do, would ever even think of doing while they were a minority in a host country. And if they don't get their way, you start to see what we're seeing now on the streets of Europe. You only need a little spark like the Israeli-Gaza conflict to set it off, and you're getting anti-Semitic riots on the streets of most capital cities in Europe. And you can see the authorities are seriously worried about this, because I'm sure most politicians thought that if they just kept a lid on the situation for long enough, they'd be able to retire to the to a place in the sunshine with their gold-plated pensions, and it would be somebody else's problem. And now, of course, they're seeing that it might actually be their problem, and they don't know what to do about it, because they haven't made any plans for what might happen with a treasonous, seditious, growing minority that's extremely aggressive and assertive, that doesn't want to integrate or assimilate. They've got these people in the country that are threatening the indigenous population, and they don't know what to do about it. Well, if they don't find a political solution, the result will be blood on the streets on a massive scale. Now, I've often said that I don't want to see this, and I wouldn't condone any kind of violence against Muslims, but if a political solution cannot be found, and the authorities, as they are doing in most Western countries at the moment, they're trying to suppress any criticism of Islam, any suggestion that Islam is anything other than a peaceful, benign and tolerant religion. And of course, trying to push forward the official line of Islam, when everybody is now starting to see through it and can see that the official line concerning Islam is a complete fiction, well, it's a recipe for disaster. And we are in for a very, very rough ride indeed if politicians with spine cannot be found and cannot be elected in order to control what is rapidly becoming an uncontrollable situation. But I'll put it back to you, Kel.
Oh, you know what? I think that we're reaching the top of the hour. We will take that break. I think this is worth discussing in further detail, because, Tim, yeah, there are very, very serious consequences happening in Europe in particular. Agador, like that you brought up the Mohammedans in Belgium. And as a matter of fact, Michael Green was my guest Friday evening at RFP, and that was the focus of one of our segments. I think that that's something that we'll do. I did find that clip of Nancy Pelosi, and this is rather interesting, that it seems that these people are deferring to other Islamic states, Qatar in particular. And Nancy Pelosi can't seem to make up her mind about what Hamas is. Like I say, she was in a scrum with the media last week, and she could not bring herself to answer the question. Pelosi does not actually endorse the notion that Hamas is a humanitarian organization. She just notes the Qatari claim. But is she giving the Qatari claim credibility? Now, here is the danger. See, this is another one. A senior politician who is lending credence to another Islamic State. Now, the only context that they have, to quote above, that Fox News Channel includes the immediate follow-up where CNN's Candy Crowley asked Pelosi whether she agrees with the U.S. designation of Hamas as a terrorist organization, and she answers, affirmatively. Kelly mocks the, is not adequately affirmative. But the clip used by Fox also stops short and does not include what ensues, where Pelosi tells Crowley, we've had that discussion. And ladies and gentlemen, that is very easy to Google. I have watched that clip with growing horror as it went on. But I have something here that me, Agador, and Tim will share with you right now.
But let me just say, any missile that comes from someplace has a return address. And if Israel is responding to that address, then it's a shame that the Palestinians are using, are rumored to be using children and families as shields for their missiles. Should we all try to, you know, first of all, avoid conflict? The Hamas initiated this. So, again, this has to be something where we try to have the two-state solution that we have to support. We have to support Abbas and his role as leader there. We have to support Iron Dome to protect the Israelis from the missiles. We have to support the Palestinians and what they need. And we have to confer with the Qataris, who have told me over and over again that Hamas is a humanitarian organization. Maybe they could use their influence to...
The U.S. thinks they're a terrorist organization, though. Correct you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we've had that discussion.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good grief. God give me strength. How could a woman in her position defer to Qatar? This is unreal to me. This appeasement is overwhelming. It leaves me literally nauseated. I literally wake up in the middle of the night screaming when I think of these so-called world leaders deferring to these Islamic states and saying, well, you know, if they say that Hamas is a humanitarian group, okay, we'll go with that. Like, oh, my God. And I'm passing the mic to Agador because this is his... representatives in the United States. And Agador, you must really wonder about the state of your U.S. government. When you hear statements like that, it is almost like you must want to pull your hair out.
I do. And certainly, pardon me, certainly it's frustrating, especially when we try to tell the rest of the world, the people, try to tell the rest of the world that these individuals do not represent us. We know that if the people had, if all of our people had all of the facts and not just the skewed news reports that we see night after night on all of our major news outlets, they would be completely behind Israel. And that is a message that people like the great Vito Esposito, who's in the chat room right now, and others are trying to get out to the rest of the world that these political weasels do not represent the true American viewpoint of Hamas and what's going on in Israel. They represent themselves. They represent their political parties. And as I said, they represent the world left, an ideology that actually thinks that it can deal with Islam. This is very similar to those who thought they could actually deal with the Soviet Union when it was in existence. And as we know, President Kennedy said in his very famous I Am a Jelly Donut speech, let them come to Berlin. But this time it's not Berlin. This time it's the Gaza Strip area and Israel. If people think, and this is what Nancy Pelosi will not say, if people think that Hamas is a charitable organization and that they only want peace, let them go to Israel. If people think that Islam is a religion of peace, let them go to Israel. If people think that the Gazan Arabs are being used as anything other than human shields, then let them go to Israel. No, you can see from that 50-year distance how far the Democratic Party in the United States of America has fallen from a president who stood before the Soviet Union and said, this far, no farther, to a former Speaker of the House who says that Qatar is the best source of information that we can come up with, giving bona fides to Hamas. And I'll turn it back over to you guys.
What we're going to do is that we are at the top of the hour, and we're going to take a break. Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to Islam Exposed with your radio hosts, Tim Burton, Agador, and Cal Fritzy. We are three hosts, three different countries with one common denominator, our love of freedom and a planet rid of the scourge. But we also want to acknowledge our people that are joining us in the studio and the chat room. Of course, we always thank our sweet Sue from New Mexico, and she works tirelessly to get the shows out for us. But we have, of course, our Bigfoot, EDL Ming. We have some guests here, welcome guests, Dito Esposito, proprietor of the Radio Jihad Network and Mine and Tim's boss, and Vorpal Bite. We've had people pop in and people pop out, but we also want to acknowledge those that listen in archive. We know you do, and we appreciate it. But we are going to take that break, and when we come back, we've got some more topics that we're going to discuss, and of course, I want to expand with Tim what's going on in Europe, and in particular, what is going on in England. But we're going to see everybody back here. Refresh your coffees, teas, get your water, and don't snort it out your nose. And we'll see everybody back here in 3 minutes.
Pounding out a beat, and I could have been a loser.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. I hope you're enjoying Islam Exposed with Tim, Agador, and myself. I'm Kel. I think people know that. There's not enough hours in the day to speak with you about what's going on. I do this 7 days a week because it's important to me. Agador does, Tim does. We are at a juncture in our history, and that we have to finally address once and for all that we are facing the greatest threat on the planet today. It's not the economy. It's not global warming. Al Gore, I'm going to sue you. It's nothing like that. What we're facing is a threat to our host countries, and that, of course, is Islam. Tim, you are in England, and you're dealing with a rather how should I put it? In the United States, they would be referred to as rhinos, and that is a Republican in name only. I guess that in England, we could say conservative in name only. You have a prime minister that is very much an appeaser, and that is, of course, David Cameron. You see what's happening about you. You see what's happening in your area where you and your family live. How is it that you touched upon this 30 minutes ago, in that we allowed this? Our liberal governments allowed this. We are now dealing with a demographic, and I don't know if there's any coming back from it. They are here, they're breeding, they're voting. Tim?
Yes, indeed. As you say, they are here, they're breeding, and they are voting. And if we were just to continue along the same lines that we have been doing over the past 40-odd years, then it's going to be a very bad picture for all our children and grandchildren. As you say, people like David Cameron and the so-called Conservative Party are indeed conservatives in name only, and they show every sign of wanting to allow the present state of affairs to continue, even though they must know where it's going to lead in due course. We have typically, over the past 40 or 50 years in this country, we've had a two-party system. Well, nominally three-party, with Conservatives and Labour sharing power in every 5 years they'll swap over. I mean, by that I mean every five or years or thereabouts, or maybe 10 years, people get so fed up with the current government, they look around and say, well, it's time for a change. So if Labour in power, typically they'll waste all the public money that they've had, and people will get totally fed up with it, and they'll vote the Conservatives in, which is what happened last time. Now we've had the Conservatives in for nearly 5 years, I wouldn't be at all surprised if we don't see a backlash against the Conservatives. But I mean, because the policies of these groups, and including liberal Democrats, who rarely get elected on their own because they're just seen like a bunch of woolly-minded sheep by most of the population, and even though they're currently aligned with the Conservatives, every time a liberal Democrat politician opens his mouth, I mean, people just laugh because their policies are just so badly thought out. But the current system that we have is totally inadequate for dealing with an existential threat to our society, the kind of threat that Islam poses. And if Islam's population, as I've said before, if it only ever stayed around the 1% mark and didn't grow in any way, this wouldn't be a big deal at all. But because of the demographic, it's going to be a huge deal, and we either tackle it now, or we may as well take the keys and hand it to the Muslims and say, let's all be ruled by Sharia law, because that is what they have in mind. And if we want to protect and preserve Judeo-Christian civilization, we're going to have to do things very differently in the next 20 years compared to what we've done in the last 40 years. And people are slowly waking up to this, and we are starting to see, see in polls, every time you have a poll, it does show that people are waking up. We had the elections in May, when people had the opportunity to vote in the European elections. There was a very noticeable increase in what would be classified as the far right vote, people like UKIP. And if that translated next year into extra seats for the UKIP party, then the Conservatives would have a great deal to worry about. And we really need, if we're going to tackle this, we need a model which is totally different from the current two-party or two-and-a-half-party model that we've had for the past 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not we're going to be able to wake up enough people in enough time to do it all peacefully is another matter. So if we certainly have to try, because the alternative is going to be unthinkable for us all. We will see the jihad come to our streets, come to our towns, and come to our cities. And when it does, then Muslims are going to make a choice, and it's not going to be in our favour. We are actually going to find the jihad on our streets, and it's just not going to be a pretty sight. Personally, I'd like not to have that happen, which I speak on the radio show, which is why we all speak on the radio show, because there are political alternatives, there are precedents, which I've spoken about in the past. I won't go into in detail now, but there are certainly precedents for dealing with problems of this nature in a way that doesn't have to result in outright civil war. And there are groups who have proposed steps that could be taken in a planned, controlled manner in order to control and constrain the existing Muslim population, to get Islam out of the public space, and to make it unpleasant for people who want to practice Islam in the way that they've currently been practicing it. I'm a great believer in what gets rewarded gets done, and people in power are doing what they're doing because they're being rewarded for it. The rewards that they see outweigh the negative implications that are going to be coming along in the future. But we have to actually change that and make it unpleasant for our politicians to take the kind of decisions that they're taking. Exactly how this might be done is the subject of maybe another complete radio show at some point in the future. But I think we're pretty much all agreed that if nothing is done and we keep going down this route, we will see civil war. And then
we lose Tim.
Tim, check your connections, my friend, if you're still with us.
I think Tim...
My apologies. Kel knows exactly what happened. I've got this microphone switch, and it's just in the wrong place. I accidentally hit it. But, I just wanted... I'll hand the microphone back in a minute, because you'll have missed that last bit that I said. But basically, if we don't want civil war, we are going to have to completely change the way in which we govern ourselves in the West. And if it can't be done peacefully, that's what's going to happen. Our children and grandchildren are going to be faced with a very unpleasant future. And it's going to be like Bosnia in the 1990s, Lebanon in the 1970s, or Iraq and Syria in the present day. And I don't think anybody wants that.
That's no exaggeration either.
And that's exactly it. We're seeing what's happening in France right now. We're seeing what's happening in France right now with the Islamic population growing. It's sitting around 13% to 15%. Tim knows the exact figures, but it's high. It's very high, and we witnessed last week Islamic riots. They called them protests, but no, they were actual riots. They had Jews holed up in their synagogues, and they were going into Jewish neighborhoods and businesses and smashing the windows. It was like France's own Kristallnacht. If But Tim, what he says is totally correct, and that if we don't deal with this right now, we're leaving a huge mess behind us, and the politicians are not helping us. I have a clip here I'm going to play. It's totally unrelated to the issues of Islam, but it's a very good clip by Brian Lilly from Sun Media in Canada here. I'll play that in a moment. I really want your gentleman's opinion on that one. But if we allow this to go down the slope, it's like a greased pole. Ever try to climb up a greased pole? Good luck with all that. We are allowing Islam, and I mean that as a collective, and I mean in particular our respective governments, to run roughshod over our interests. They are not taking care of us. They're not taking care of us in Canada, while to a lesser extent Stephen Harper is trying to. They certainly are not in the United States, and I think England has been trying to run up that grease pole. We are the people. We are the employers. We vote for these people, but we get voted out because of the voting blocks. And when Islam comes to town, like Tim says, where will your happy, smiling neighbor be standing? Will we see situations like we saw in Lebanon or Syria, where your neighbors are wonderful, wonderful people, and you exchange vegetables, from the garden over the fence, and you have happy, chatty time? But then when they get the command, the Islamists will slaughter you. We saw what happened in Israel a few years back with the Fogel family. That is Gazan Arabs, and this is what they're doing in Israel right now. Israel has been shutting down tunnels left, right, and center. We have to stand with Israel and let Israel settle this, and we have to keep our governments out of it. Canada has endorsed Israel's quest to rid Hamas once and for all, but we have governments globally. It's not only the United States, Canada, England. It's the UK. It's all over Europe, the West in general. We all have to stand as a collective, and we all have to get rid of those that will not support Israel's right to exist. I just went off on a bit of a tangent, my apologies, but I am wrapping it up in a neat little bowl. And that we have a right to question our politicians. We have a right to vote them out. But as Tim mentioned, it's difficult because we have voting blocks and we have immigrants that breed prolifically. It is it's a hard game to keep up on. We are going to be on the losing side. If we don't do something right now, we are going to lose this football match. And I want to pass it to Vorpal Byte. Vorpal Byte. I want to pass it. I'm just reading Vorpal Byte in the chat room. Rick and rack and rock and ruck and get your bums and really gah! And go Duke crew. Thanks, for that's very nice. But I want to pass nice. It to Agador. And what do you think is going to happen in November when you have your by-elections? Do you think you'll get the House and Senate back?
All right. Well, the Senate, I think we'll retain control of the House. Now, how conservative the House becomes at the end of that is anyone's guess. My sense is that we are not going to have enough to swing enough seats over to the conservative side, not the Republican side, but the conservative side, to get people like do-nothing speakers like John Boehner out. So it may be a stagnant situation there. It may be, but there is a glimmer of hope. I think somewhat slightly more hope that the Senate might possibly swing Republican. All right, but we have to be careful there, too, because we could wind up with a lot of rhinos there. A lot of the people in – a lot of the Republicans in the Senate now, as it is, are rhinos, and we have to be careful that we don't just put in more rhinos, because at that point there'll be really no difference. It'll just be the letter after their name. And by the way, I heard a term some time ago, less than a year, but I really liked it. It's called CONE, conservative only near elections. And I think we have those around the world.
Yeah.
But yes, that's my sense for the House and the Senate. I'm very guardedly optimistic, and we'll just have to wait and see what happens and keep encouraging people to research their candidates. Don't just go by the party and vote for the conservatives that are going to stop so many of the horrific things that are going on now. And in the context of what we're talking about here on this show, the funding of things like the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas and various other organizations that are just going to channel money back into Islamic terrorism. That's my sense, and I will turn it back over to you guys.
Thank you, Agador. I agree with that. Like I say, we have to hold our governments accountable because we're the employers. They work for us. We have to stop the bureaucrats and the lobby groups from interfering with the work of the government of whom we employ. We are the people. We are the voters. We have a right to question what our governments, respective governments, are doing, and when it comes to Islam, it sure as hell doesn't seem like they're doing very much right now. We have heard on clips from Nancy Pelosi and Hillary Clinton. It is shocking to me that this is happening in our midst. Everything we know about Islam and the threat of Islam in our respective countries should be a forefront. It should be a platform when the polls open up. And you have to question your representatives, whether it be your state representative, whether it be your provincial representative. It doesn't matter. You have to ask hard questions. And you have to insist that Islam be addressed, because Islam is encouraging very nefarious activities in the West. Of course, the biggest threat being Sharia law. Islam is not a religion. It is a political party. It is violent. It is full of subjugation. Donkeys are worth more than women in this ideology. It is horrifying. But what I'm going to do, I want to play this clip right now, Agador and Tim. And I know some people may or may not agree with everything that Brian Lilly says, but this is how government should work. And we'll see everybody back here in 7 minutes. It's a very long clip, but it's worth your time to listen to. Oh, you.
Prime Time on Sun News Network brings you Brian Lilly and Ezra Levant. Two hosts, one mission, to bring you the real stories with all the facts, interviews, and analysis you need, night after night, back to back.
Canada's broken democracy, that is the topic of tonight's byline. The system is broken. Canada is supposed to be a Westminster-style democracy, one modeled on the British system. An upper house, a lower house. This is supposed to be the legislative branch of government. We also have an executive branch, the cabinet, the administration. We've got a judicial branch. These three branches are supposed to act as checks and balances upon each other. But increasingly, it's not working out that way. What I find shocking as I talk to people across Canada that want to see things change is how little Canadians know about how the system is supposed to work. I'm not talking about this audience. This audience is smart. You are plugged in, you are engaged, then your friends, your family, your neighbors, the people that aren't plugged in. Well, tonight I want to speak to them through you. On tonight's show, we're going to go through what's happening now in Canadian politics, talk about how things should work, how they aren't working, and how to fix them. If you get the feeling that Parliament has less and less power, well, you're not mistaken. We elect MPs to represent our local areas in the nation's meeting place, the House of Commons, in Parliament. They're supposed to be there not as their party's representatives in the local areas to you back home, but instead represent your area in Ottawa. That part is one of the things that's not working. Part of the reason? Well, too much party control, not enough independence, too many cabinet ministers or people that want to be cabinet ministers. But even cabinet ministers don't have the power they should. And I'm not just talking about those people that think Stephen Harper keeps all his ministers on short leashes. That sort of thing's been happening my entire life. I'm talking about the troubling push to take away power from cabinet ministers and give it to unelected bureaucrats. There are plenty of examples in this, including the furor a few years ago over Bev Oda, who was then in charge of Canada's foreign aid money, and she rejected a $7 million grant to a group called Kairos. The bureaucrats recommended the funding go ahead, Oda acting as minister, and on behalf of the executive branch, she rejected the funding. The controversy over a minister rejecting the advice of your bureaucrats, well, that lasted for months. How dare she, was the cry. Well, she was the minister. But to the media party and to the opposition parties, this was unthinkable. And the same happened when the government decided to stop jailing people for refusing to fill out the long form census. Without jail time hanging over the heads of Canadians, the media opposition complex claimed that the information gathered would be useless. And besides, top bureaucrats disagreed with this idea. Right now, there's a showdown between Mark Mayrand, the unelected head of Elections Canada, and the elected part of the government. And they're fighting over how to change Canada's elections laws. You can guess what side the media opposition complex is coming down on. They think the elected officials should listen to the bureaucrats. What none of them seem to realize is we don't elect bureaucrats, we elect MPs. And if MPs vote a certain way, then it is the job of the bureaucrats to carry out the orders of the MPs. And it is not, and never has been, the job of an MP to do what the bureaucrats tell them to do. You know what's funny about this, though, is that the same people that complain about Stephen Harper consolidating power in his office actually advocate for more power for unelected bureaucrats, who, I should point out, are part of the same executive branch headed up by the Prime Minister. You can't decry the consolidation of power by one part of the executive and call for further consolidation of power by another part of the executive. But they do that, and they do it in the name of taking the politics out of decisions. So we have more tribunals and boards, arm's-length groups making more and more decisions, and elected officials making fewer decisions. Let me be clear. When someone says we need to take the politics out of something that government is supposed to do, you need to ignore that person. I'd like to actually tell you to punch them in the face, but I'm trying not to advocate violence. Recently, the government decided to change a number of Canada's gun laws and, in effect, rescind a decision by the RCMP that banned legal guns and turned more than 12,000 law-abiding Canadians into criminals. You can guess how the progressives in the media opposition complex reacted.
With 12,000 of them out there, what we should actually be doing is recalling them and getting them out of the hands of Canadians.
Why should those firearms be recalled, Mr. Capstick? I'm not going to call Ian Capstick a crazy gun grabber. He knows his firearms, even if he puts out false information that makes it sound like semi-automatics are inherently dangerous firearms that no Canadian should own. I think that what bothers him here, what upsets him, is that the government's decision goes against the wishes of bureaucrats. Capstick is an NDP partisan. Well, here's what NDP public safety critic Randall Garrison said after the announced changes to Canada's gun laws and regulations. He told the Canadian press, clearly the Conservatives are interfering with the decision of the RCMP. What we have is firearms experts who have made a judgment based on public safety considerations, and the Conservatives are now reversing that based on political considerations. And heaven forbid a politician say something that a bureaucrat disagrees with. With this kind of thinking from Garrison and the like, why don't we just stop having elections? We just let the bureaucrats or the courts make all the decisions. Courts used to consider challenges to laws. Now our elected officials, or at least the progressive ones, want the courts to approve laws before they're even passed. That's what's happening as the government looks to change the prostitution laws.
How can making the Johns be in an illegal situation even more clearly enhance the security of sex workers? It's an obvious contradiction. So we're saying, instead of just having a political debate about this, because we know that the Conservatives don't listen to anyone anyway, send it to the Supreme Court of Canada, get a ruling on it, and then we can all know whether we're on solid ground with this.
Tom Mulcair wants the courts to give him approval to vote on something. Justin Trudeau, the Liberal leader, also wants the courts to sign off on legislation before it's even voted on. He said, we also note the government has refused to submit this legislation to a reference to the Supreme Court of Canada in order to determine its constitutional validity. Democracy, the idea that man can govern his own affairs, is not a new idea. But it's also not the natural state of affairs. Much of the world still doesn't have it, and even those places that do have had to fight, continually fight for it. Just think, it was only 177 years ago that rebels in Quebec and Ontario were fighting to chip away at the power of unelected elites that thought they should rule these colonies without input from the people they ruled. And 2 years earlier, Joseph Howe faced jail time and a trial for pointing out corruption of Nova Scotia's ruling elite in his newspaper. The push for responsible government in Canada was hard-fought, whether we're talking about the rebels, the reformers, the first elected officials in this country, whether we're talking about our political ancestors all the way back to the nobles that forced King John's hand to sign the Magna Carta at Runnymede, or those that fight to maintain democracy today. Our ability to have a say in how our lives should be governed, that should not slip away into the waiting clutches of unelected bureaucrats or unaccountable judges. It's taken a long time to get to this point, and we shouldn't give up without a fight. And that's the byline.
And that is exactly it. One thing I have a bit of a disagreement with Brian Lilly, and him being my Facebook friend, yes, I'm name dropping, is that we are not ruled. We depend on good governance. And we are the rulers. We elect these people in to take care of us. And that clip, I just wanted to give everybody a little bit of a taste of a Canadiana. And there were a lot of points in there that resonated with me. And in the United States, you have the Second Amendment in that you have the right to bear arms. In Canada, we're monitored very, very closely. In England, you can't own a firearm. I picked up so many salient points with that clip that I don't even know where to begin. But I do want to pass the mic to first Tim in a moment, and that is that, yes, we, the pressure from unelected special interest groups and lobby groups in determining our policy, our government policy. You heard in there on that clip that Justin Trudeau was wanting to have legislation passed before there was even a vote in the House of Commons. That is shocking and disgusting to me. I am flabbergasted by that. But Tim, when you open up, I don't know, maybe your national dailies, and you see that there is some special interest group, particularly the Islamic special interest groups, whether in the United States it's CARE, in Canada it's CARE Canada, in England I'm sure you have the same special interest groups, and they are pushing for legislation with your government. How does that make you feel?
Well, I suppose the first thing to say that is in a democracy, I don't think you can run a democracy without having special interest groups of one sort or another. And, of course, the way in which these special interest groups gain results is by making sure they're as highly organized as they can be. Now, despite how much we may hate any special interest group which is pushing an Islamist agenda, the fact is that they are really quite well organized and they're well funded and they know how to press all the right buttons when it comes to influencing our legislators. So how do I feel about that? Well, I wish they didn't have so much influence. I wish that there was a counter interest group that said, well, hang on, what about the rights of the indigenous population? When a Muslim special interest group puts this side forward, we should have an extremely strong counter-argument that says, well, every time a Muslim special interest group proposes something that's in favour of Islam or Muslims, that takes away from the freedoms and the rights of the rest of us. Now, we haven't had that. Typically, Muslim special interest groups in this country have been steamrolling through, getting in touch with all the people who make the decisions about how things run in our country, steamrolling mm-hmm. through with the help of large amounts of money, it has to be said. And I'm not suggesting that all politicians are corrupt enough to have Swiss bank accounts and just stick the banknotes in their back pocket and so on. But nevertheless, money does talk. And these special interest groups are extremely well funded. And they are passionate about what they do. Now, the opposition groups that might be standing up for the rights of the indigenous population just aren't sufficiently passionate about what they do. They're not well funded. They're not well organized. And to try and get people sufficiently interested to do that is an uphill struggle, because most people, if they're asked, would you like to be part of a special interest group, they'll say, well, I'm too busy trying to earn a living, keep a roof over my head, pay the mortgage, food on the table, feed me kids, yeah. to get involved. But of course, Muslims don't have to make that calculation. They have as many kids as they want. They can bring in, you know, as many wives as they want and get as much welfare and benefits as they, much more than they actually need, because many Muslims send that money back to, you know, well, this is welfare benefit money I'm talking about. They send it out of the country back to their countries of origin to look after their extended families. So they've got tons of money. They don't have to worry about holding down a job. In fact, many Muslims, 50% of males and 75% of females in this country, Muslims, do not, they're not in employment or doing anything that involves paying taxes or giving back to the economy. And that's from the Equalities Commission report in 2012 that was reported on by the Daily Telegraph. I do have a link, but I haven't got it to hand. So they've got loads of time on their hand. They can get organized. They're very passionate about it because they want to push Islam as the one and only way of doing things in this country. So they're very highly motivated, lots of money, loads of time. They've got everything on their side. So it's all very one-sided. So the short answer to that is I'm not happy that we don't have a decent opposition that can stand up and say, if Muslims are allowed to do this for very much longer, we are going to be a completely ineffectual minority in our own country, and when Muslims sense that they've reached the right point, they will wage war on us. They will drive us out and slaughter us, because that over 1400 years is what they have done in other countries, and it's worked very well for them. Why would they change their way of doing things in this country? They won't. When they reach the appropriate point, that's what will happen. And we haven't got an appropriate opposition to stand up against it at the moment. We need it. What can we do to motivate people? I'm not really sure. What can we do to get them to be more well-funded? Again, I'm not really sure. And as far as what can we do to give people time to become involved? Well, that's another tricky one, because people, as I say, are very tied up with earning a living and putting food on the table. And they actually make a conscious decision to limit the number of children that they have according to how much money they have. Muslims don't make that calculation. They just have loads of kids, and they expect that we the indigenous British taxpayer will pay for it. They don't make a calculation to stop after one or two kids because they can't afford it, whereas the indigenous population does make that calculation. And we've done it because typically we've thought that we would always have a nice, peaceful, quiet country to live in, and we would be able to balance our children, the upbringing of children with a satisfying work-life balance. And most people, when they're faced with that, they don't necessarily want to have four, five, six kids because that's hard work. They would prefer to do something that's perhaps more satisfying in terms of the work that they do and the leisure life that they had. And the end result is we're now being outbred by a bunch of people who are not making the same calculations. So what do I think about it? Well, I'm appalled, to be honest, but the situation is what it is. And if we don't find a way around it, as I say, there will be blood on the streets. It all comes down to what many people have been putting in the chat room tonight, that we're on a course for civil war. And I would certainly agree with that. And from what I've seen in our capital cities throughout Europe, that civil war... In the last few weeks, that civil war is much closer than we think. It's only going to need a spark equivalent to the Israel-Gaza conflict to ignite something that is going to give us the blood on the street scenario that I've been talking about for the past couple of years.
I absolutely agree with that. As a Canadian, I'm very distressed when I see unelected officials dictating government policy. And Brian Lilly alluded to that in that 7-minute clip. And that was a very long clip, ladies and gentlemen, but I hope you enjoyed it because he was deferring to Canada, but he was speaking globally as well in that... This is something that seriously has to be avoided. Like, I don't mind checks and balances. Of course, we have to keep our governments accountable. And, yes, lobby groups and special interest groups, yes, they have their place. But when they dictate policy as is presented, whether it be in Parliament or the Senate or the House, then we have to start being concerned. And Agador has something he's going to present, and this is courtesy of EDL Minx. And Minx, thank you so much for this clip. But before you get to that, Agador, what do you think about special interest groups and lobby groups?
I think the air conditioner's fallen on him, Kel.
Did we lose? Nope, he's... Oh, you know what? It would help if I unmuted him.
Thank you. All right. Yeah, Jim pointed out something very important, and it's a big reason why we don't have more people woken up in this society. There are too many people in all of our societies. There are too many people who are living in a state of denial. We've all grown up, thanks largely to our parents' and grandparents' sacrifices, in comfortable countries with a reasonable expectation that if we go out there and apply ourselves, we'll have a reasonable chance at a certain amount of success in life. We know that we're probably not going to starve. We know that we're probably not going to sleep tonight without a roof over our head. So many things have been assured for us in the past that it is really difficult to conceive that all of that could be swept away in the next 10, 15, 20 years by an onslaught of basically haters who breed like rabbits on crack. But this is the absolute point. It is the most distressing thing. It is why we're going to have to work as hard as we are, and it is why time is so important too. As I said, the next 10 to 15 to 20 years is going to tell a lot. I would say that the world of at this moment, the world of the year 2025, And certainly the world of the year 2030 look like an extremely scary place if we do not become active. Now, you mentioned and wanted to my opinion on special interest groups, and we're inundated with them here in the States. In fact, the West has all of them. And they do have a certain reach and a certain amount of power. Now, I'll give you an example. Our Internal Revenue Service here in the United States, which is our government, our federal taxing agency, has long had a problem with the Tea Party movement in our country, which is an organization, not so much
terrorist
an organization. Well, a terrorist organization as far as this one special interest group of bureaucrats is concerned. Now, why is that? The word TEA means taxed enough already. It doesn't have anything to do with the incident of the Sons of Liberty throwing tea into Boston Harbor. Although it's branched out from its original formulation of like-minded people who said we've just been taxed enough already, that's always been at its base. And one of the things that most people who call themselves Tea Party movement supporters have wanted to do here in the States is to remove the Internal Revenue Service and replace that with what's known as a flat tax or a fair tax. Now, when you put someone else's job in danger, how do you think they're going to react? And these people in the IRS complied very readily, I think, with the enemies of the Tea Party movement in the upper echelons of our government, to try and make things difficult for us and to weaponize that one agency against the people in the Tea Party movement. This is not a special interest group per se, but it is a group of bureaucrats that have turned themselves into a special interest group. And that special interest just happens to be maintaining their jobs and maintaining the status quo, despite the fact that doing something else might actually help the American people. And there has been much talk in the time that I've observed politics about special interest groups and lobbying in our nation's capital. As Tim points out very rightly, these groups are very well funded. Sometimes they're funded from outside sources, as with, for instance, the Muslim Students Association.
Oh, absolutely.
But sometimes they're funded by just ordinary people's donations, such as the National Rifle Association. And they use that funding to work for and achieve specific goals, and that does include lobbying our leaders and in some cases maybe sweetening the deal a little bit just to make sure that legislation goes our way. It's an overriding problem in, as I see it, in the West. I don't think it's anything we'll ever get rid of as long as we have civilization, but it is something that we can try and put tighter controls on, and all come to a mutual understanding that we will elect people to represent us, and they will do so, and govern us with our approval, and let's allow the bureaucrats to simply shuffle the papers around, not become special interest groups themselves, and put a tighter control on the special interest groups. Because in the context of the show we're having now, we can see how some of these special interest groups are furthering the cause of global Islam. And this is not going to be good for our countries, as I've said, by, say, the years 2025 to 2030. I think if we don't do something, it's going to be a much darker world. And I'll throw it back to you guys.
I am in so much agreement. I can't even begin to, deconstruct everything you have said, but Agador, I am in so much in agreement, and Special interest groups, they really do influence the voting bloc. And this is my corner of dissension, is the voting blocs. I'm very concerned about the influence that special interest groups sway in opinion. This has got to stop. And I like what Vito Esposito said in the chat room, terminate all special interest groups. Yes, and terminate their funding. Because we know it's like Animal Farm. Some groups are more important than other groups. And the groups that we see becoming more important, and I'm using my air quotes here, are those of Islamic special interest groups. Of course, the biggie is CARE, the Council of American Islamic Relations. Get rid of them. Shut them down. But hey, Agador, we've got something here that EDL Minx put in the chat room, and you would love to expand on this, and please do.
All right. Now, this Minx brought this in, and again, and thank you, Minx. She brought this in. This is comments from Senator Harry Reid, who is the Democratic Majority Leader in the United States Senate. And I'm not really sure what our president is going to do with this quote. Honestly, now that I've had a few moments to think about it and digest it a little bit, I think that what he's going to do is pretty much ignore it. He'll probably, if he's asked about it at all by the media, who love to bow in front of him and ask him to unzip his pants, he will very likely only say that that Senator Reid is acting in the best interests of his party and of the United States Senate. He'll give some generic answer that will mean nothing. But what Senator Reid does have to say here, and I think you have an audio, what Senator Reid does have to say here is significant, and I think people should listen to it, because it's a nice contrast to what Nancy Pelosi and Slick Hilly, or Hillary Clinton, have been saying. So I'll toss it back over to you.
It is interesting. I like what he says, and yes, I have an audio clip, and he's right. When Hamas fires these rockets, Hamas has no idea, where they'll land. Military installation, they hope. A daycare center, they don't care. Empty parking lot, they don't care. They're just firing these rockets indiscriminately. So let's listen to his statement. And let's hope I don't get a pop-up.
Mr. President, our great country has many friends in the world. We're proud of all the alliances that we have, but certainly our deepest attachment is what we have with Israel. The United States and Israel have stood by each other in good times and bad times, in times of peace and times of war. Right now, our friends in the state of Israel are under attack. Hamas continues to indiscriminately fire thousands of rockets into Israel, with the sole objective of inflicting casualties on somebody, anybody. Mr. President, I was watching the News Hour. Every Friday they have a commentary by usually Brooks and Shield. Shield is supposedly the Democrat, and Brooks the Republican. David Brooks said so descriptively, he had never seen a conflict or read about a conflict in the past where one of the participants said, kill some more of my people. That's what Hamas is saying. When Hamas fires these rockets, Hamas has no idea where they'll land. Military installation, they hope. A daycare center, they don't care. Empty parking lot, they don't care. They're just firing these rockets indiscriminately. Israel doesn't have the luxury of not worrying about where these rockets land, though. They must respond swiftly in shooting out all rockets, or else risk serious harm to its people. In thwarting these rocket attacks, Israel depends on what is termed and named the Iron Dome. It's a missile defense system But as the number of rockets being launched from Gaza continue to surge, Israel's Iron Dome resources are necessarily being depleted. Last week, United States Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel requested Congress allocate $225 million in emergency funding to help Israel reinforce its defense system. After 3 weeks of fighting, Israel needs these funds to replace a weaponry it's used to destroy Hamas incoming rockets. But there's no guarantee that Israel won't need our help again. Mr. President, if this conflict continues for weeks or months, what this funding does do for the time being, though, is provide Israel with the resources to continue defending its people from these terrorist attacks. Last Thursday, the Republican leader urged the Senate to act quickly in approving the defense secretary's request. I agree with my friend, the Republican leader. We must pass legislation providing Israel with this critical aid. But in my opinion, $225 million being requested is only temporary, Mr. President. If Hamas continues to escalate this conflict, Israel's resources, including the funding requested by the Secretary of Defense, will quickly be depleted. With its current number of batteries, Israel has to prioritize popular areas and strategically important locations. These are mobile. It's a mobile system. They're in Dome. They have to move it around. That means, unfortunately, that there are some Israelis still susceptible to Hamas's rocket attacks. We should not give the Israeli people the minimum amount of aid and then cross our fingers and hope it all works out in the future. Each missile battery costs Israel about $50 million. Each missile Israel shoots to knock down one of those rockets on Gaza Strip costs about $62,000. Hamas has already fired 2,500 of these rockets in just 3 weeks. And as we speak, they're going up. They continue to fire them. As we know, they're located in schools, neighborhoods. They're hidden all over in mosques. Taking into account what Israel actually needs to adequately protect its people, the United States and its other allies should consider providing more aid to do more for the Iron Dome. Our Israeli friends shouldn't be in the position of picking and choosing which part of the country to defend. The United States of America should live up to its commitments, particularly with our friend Israel, which happens to be the only true democracy in the Middle East. We can do better, and we need to go further in protecting Israel. That being said, it's critical that we approve the money requested by Secretary Hagel now. Coming to defense of Israel is not a partisan issue, Mr. President. It's an American principle. Both Democrats and Republicans should agree on this measure.
And, oh, wow, what I can say is only, oh, wow. And Harry Reid, being a Democrat, will the president listen? Oh, and Minx, EDL Minx, thank you so very much for that. We've been playing a lot of clips tonight, but we're dealing with something extraordinarily important, and that is the Israel-Gazan-Arab conflict. It's a war. We want Israel to carry on unfettered and get the job done. Gentlemen, I don't believe this, but we're out of time.
Doesn't time fly when you're enjoying yourself?
What I want to do is I want you two gentlemen to wrap up your final talking points, and I'll start with you, Tim.
Yeah, okay. I was listening to the Harry Reid clip with some interest, because every time I've heard the name Harry Reid mentioned over the past couple of years, it seems to me it's always been in connection with something that's against conservative interests. And here he is putting forward an argument for supporting Israel. Well, okay, that's a good thing. When you hear somebody like this who suddenly takes a position that you actually support, because obviously as people on this program know, I am a great supporter of Israel, and when to hear something like that coming from Harry Reid, well, it's very welcome. I suppose I should put away the skeptical side of my character, the side of my character that people call old Mr. Cynical, and I should give Harry Reid the benefit of the doubt. And I think I'll probably leave commenting any more on that until I've seen a little bit more about what people who are more versed in American politics have to say about it. But nevertheless, that was a very, very interesting clip, and I'm indebted to EDL Minx for popping it into the chat room for us. Other than that, I have really enjoyed this show tonight. I'd like to thank you, Agador, and you, Kel, for helping to bring the truth to all our listeners. And I'd especially like to say a big thank you to Kel for her production and moderation techniques. As I've always said, the best producer, moderator and co-host that a red-blooded male could wish for, and certainly true on this occasion. So thanks again, and I'll pass the microphone back to you.
And thank you, Tim. And Agador, your closing commentary?
Okay, well, on the clip, I would just like to say that I'm personally worried for Senator Reid. I hope he had a medical checkup after he said that, because he might have had internal injuries from actually telling the truth and doing something to actually support Israel. So, much of a political enemy as he is in my eyes, I do have a humanitarian side and want to make sure that that he's okay. But no,
is that like the humanitarian side that Hillary Clinton was Nancy Pelosi was talking about when she was talking about a humanitarian? Yes, of course. I just one final thing I'd just like to throw in there, Aggie. You know, it would be a terrible thing if tomorrow morning we'd read in the headlines that Harry Reid had met with an accidental freak accident while he was buttering his toast or combing his hair, you know, because that's the kind of thing you expect to sort of read when you see something so startling in the news. Anyway, sorry about that. I interrupted you there. I'm going to pass you back the mic and let you carry on to wrap up.
All right. Well, yes, we should watch the headlines the next few days, because you could well be right. But that's my comment on the video. It is an encouraging sign. If we do quote unquote interfere in this war, and let's just be honest and say it's a war. At all, it should be in this way. We should support Israel with our borrowed Chinese money, and not support Hamas with our borrowed Chinese money, and let Israel do the job that it let the IDF do the job that it knows how to do. That's step back and let them work. And I want to say in closing here that, it's always a pleasure. I always get a bit nervous when I work with two heavyweights like you, Tim, and you, Kel, because you two are very knowledgeable. But in the end, I find myself wanting the show to go on for another 2 hours, because the depth of knowledge and expertise that you guys bring to the mic every time is an absolute joy to work with, and I am honored to be in your company. Kel, you are a as the French might say, producer extraordinaire. You can take a complete disaster of a show and turn it into something that is just as smooth as butter, as they might say on the East Coast. So thank you for everything you do, Tim. Again, always a pleasure working with you. Everyone, I encourage everyone to look for Tim's articles at Brenner Brief, and to follow him on Facebook.
Oh, yeah.
And I encourage everyone also to listen to Tim and Kel, who do excellent programs here on Blog Talk Radio. And I encourage everyone, of course, to listen to The Unpleasant Blind Guy, which comes on at 6:45 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on Pundit Press Radio. And look for a new one of those probably next week. And Kel, thank you very much again, and I will pass the mic back to you to close it out, baby.
Absolutely. And ladies and gentlemen, please scroll up in the show notes and please look at the slides. That's the hardest part of my job is putting the slides in there. You will see the links for Tim at Brenner Brief, and you will see the link for AGG at Pundit Press. All the links are there. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you all so very much for joining us. Tim, AGG, it's been a blast. We will see everybody back here tomorrow night on the Red Fox Blogger, where I fly solo, and I am totally unapologetic as I am left to my own devices. Everybody, have a wonderful evening. Have a wonderful week, and we will see you back here next Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on Islam Exposed. And remember, it is mass Islamity. We have to stop the insanity. Good night, gentlemen.
Yeah, good night, Kel. Good night, Agador.
Good night, Kel. Good night, Jim.
What they do? They shout in your face. All the time they want to take your place. The backstabbers. They do.